I notice how the room has filled up since I got here, and I was thinking about my talk, I guess, and not noticing as how it was filling up. So welcome, everyone. We are now in the fifth week of the 2019 practice period. And the practice period is entitled Our Chinese Ancestors. Over this period, we have heard many wonderful talks on a number of our Chinese Zen ancestors by our teachers and former Shusos. And tonight, we'll talk about Zhao Zhu, another one of our Chinese Zen ancestors. I want to take a moment to look at the word ancestor. I recognized during this practice period that the word ancestor had always had a profound impact on me. I noticed that the word evoked a feeling of gratitude, a wanting to honor those or that which came before me. I'm not sure why. Maybe it's because at some level I knew that it was because of them that I am here today. As I prepared this talk, I observed the meaning of the word ancestor expand from being limited to blood ancestors or family to including my spiritual ancestors. And as I prepared this talk, I observed the meaning of the word ancestor expand from being limited to, while I only know several generations of my forebears, because my grandparents came to this country as illiterate refugees from the chaos of Eastern Europe only 125 years ago, I know that there are forebears, albeit unknown to me, and who preceded them. It may have been my reflection, the reflection of an aging man on family and the passage of time, which reminded me of another equally important ancestry, my spiritual ancestry. And it was actually an emotional moment in which I remembered that as part of my receiving the precepts, I was gifted this little package which listed my spiritual lineage going right back to the Buddha. By now, you can tell that the fall season, and not just this one, is a melancholic and introspective time of year for me. Maybe that is just what a practice period is intended to evoke. Regardless, since we are studying ancestors, I invite you all to listen to this and all talks during this practice period against a background of deepened gratitude, and have it be an opportunity to honor our Zen ancestors as well as our blood ancestors. Blood ancestors are also important teachers. At times, their guidance and example taught us how to live. At other times, their example may have taught us how not to live. Yet, they contributed so much to us being here today. You may wonder why we are talking about Chinese ancestors, considering that Buddhism originated in India. So even though the history of Buddhism is not the subject of this talk, I will summarize why Chinese ancestors are important. Buddhism spread from India in many directions, following many different routes. Buddhism first spread to China some 2,000 years ago. The root of our lineage of Buddhism, which became Soto Zen, was from India to China some 500 years later. Once in China, Buddhism incorporated the influences of the predominant religious philosophies of the time, which were Taoism and Confucianism. Thus emerged a new variety of Buddhism in China known as Chan. Chan developed, blossomed, then made its way to Japan as Zen, growing deep roots into Japanese culture. From Japan, it made its way to North America in the last century. And our gathering here today is part of Zen's unfolding and flowering on this continent. To give you an allegorical illustration of how the essential teachings of Buddhism in China morphed into Zen as we know it, I refer to a traditional subject in Chinese religious and philosophical art forms. The subject, a rather odd one I thought, but significant by its oddness, is the vinegar tasters. The vinegar tasters is a presentation of three wise men tasting vinegar. The more I looked into this, I realized there are hundreds of paintings and sculptures that seem to be competing for the best representation of the personalities and characters of the three men. And I brought several copies of one particular painting that I will put out on the table in the kitchen for you can have a look at it during tea. The concept of the painting depicts the three founders of China's three major religious and philosophical traditions, Confucianism, Buddhism, and Taoism. Each painting or sculpture engulfs a huge amount of wisdom and knowledge. We see the Buddha, Confucius, and Lao Tzu standing around a vat full of vinegar. Each one of these masters dips their finger and tastes and takes a taste of the vinegar. The expression on each man's face shows his individual reaction, with each man representing a philosophical and religious teaching, the vinegar representing the essence of life, and the reaction represents each teaching's overview toward life and its essence. The Buddha is depicted having a bitter look on his face. Confucius, with a sour expression, and we find Lao Tzu wearing a smile of satisfaction. Several interpretations grew out of the Buddha's reaction to the taste of vinegar. One interpretation is that Buddhism, being concerned with the self, viewed the vinegar as a polluter of the body due to its extreme and intense flavor. Another interpretation for the reaction, and the one I personally favor, is that Buddhism reports on life as it is, in which vinegar is vinegar and isn't naturally sweet on the tongue. Rather, it acquires an extreme bitter taste. Trying to represent vinegar, which is a metaphor here for the essence of life, as sweet and ignoring and denying what it truly is. Confucius saw life as sour, in need of rules to correct the degeneration of people, and believed that the present was out of step with the past, and that the government had no understanding of the way of the universe in which the right response would be reverence of the ancestors and their tradition. Confucius, being concerned with the outside world, viewed the vinegar as polluted wine. In the vinegar tasters, Lao Tzu is found smiling. Why? Well, it is said before the vinegar found, as was said before, the vinegar found in the allegory represents life, and certainly in reality must most certainly have an unpleasant taste, as the expression on the faces of the other two men indicate. Yet, living in harmony and accordance with life and the Tao, this understanding transforms what others may perceive as negative into something positive. From the Taoist point of view, sourness and bitterness come from the interfering and unappreciative mind. Life itself, when understood and utilized for what it is sweet. This was the message, one of the messages, with a more Taoist interpretation of the vinegar tasters. I'm imagining another piece of history to add to this, and it goes like this. After the vinegar tasting, the vinegar tasters looked at one another, paused, realizing that all three of their perspectives had merit, and agreed to merge them into a super practice that they would call Chan. I'm not sure whose idea it may have been, or if this is what actually happened, but I do want to point out the remarkable harmony that exists among many Eastern religions. And that struck me as in contrast to what I see as greater competition among more Western religions. Having given you some background of the era in which Master Zhaozhu practiced, I will now talk about Master Zhaozhu. While Zhaozhu appears in many places in Zen literature, my main source for this talk is a book entitled The Recorded Sayings of Zen Master Zhaozhu. And it's one that's in the library here. It is the only known compilation of its kind, and it was most likely compiled by Hui Tsung, an immediate disciple dated 56 years after the death of Zhaozhu. The book was subsequently edited, translated into Japanese, and only in 1972 translated into English. The book consists of three sections. One is lectures, and these are all, as the book says, recorded sayings of Zhaozhu. It consists of lectures, questions and answers, and contains some of the best koan reading that I have ever encountered. Part two is questions and answers, and is the meatiest part of the book, with more koans, longer stories, and numerous pithy and feisty exchanges. Part three is poems and records from pilgrimages, containing some beautiful, even tender poetry. And Michael mentioned this is one of the characteristics of Zhaozhu. He was a poet as well as a master, which had quite a personality, I'm finding out. The facts known about Zhaozhu's life are few. He was born in 778 in the countryside of northern China and died in 897. After being initiated as a monk, he traveled to seek out his own teacher. At the age of 18, he met Nanchuan, one of the most brilliant of the many successors of Matsu, and eventually received Dharma transmission from him. We'll go over the story of their encounter a little later in this talk. Zhaozhu continued to reside at Nanchuan's temple until the latter's death in 835. Zhaozhu was 57. One can see that these two masters practiced together for almost 20 years. Following a three-year period of mourning, Zhaozhu started out on a pilgrimage throughout China, saying, "Even if it is a boy of 7 years, if he is better than me, I will ask his teaching. Even if it is a man of 100 years, if he is not as good as me, I will instruct him." Traveling for 20 years, he visited all the prominent Chan masters of his day, and finally, at the age of 80, took up residence in a dilapidated temple in northern China. This was the Kuan Yin Wan in the province of Zhao. Zhaozhu literally means province of Zhao, so there's a bit of confusion there. Zhaozhu is his given name, which actually means province of Zhao. He lived at Kuan Yin Wan for 40 years. So he got there at the age of 80, and he lived there for 40 years, teaching a small number of monks who gathered around until his death at the age of 120. Actually, in our terms, it would have been 119, because in China, a person is 1 year old at birth. Zhao Zhi was an enigmatic old man, twice as old as most of the other Chan masters of the day. He had deepened his own realization through personally lived experience, and whose truth could be seen in his words and actions. Although Zhao Zhi was one of the greatest Zen teachers of the Tang Dynasty, his personal line of descendants was weak and short-lived. One way of accounting for this is to realize not only that the living conditions of his temple were severe, cold winters and basic poverty, but that northern China was increasingly engulfed in feudal warfare as the dominion of the Tang Dynasty weakened. Thus, the number of monks able to live in this part of China under these conditions was limited. And to give you an idea of Zhao Zhi's living conditions at this dilapidated temple in the last 40 years of his life, I will read you a poem from part 3 of the book. It is a poem by Zhao Zhi in which he describes, I believe, a typical day in which, with much equanimity. Since it is the last poem in the book, I guess that it was composed towards the end of his life. I imagine it being the reflections of a somewhat tired, perhaps weakened, old man describing the harshness and poverty of the conditions at his broken-down temple that he had endured so long. And the poem describes life hour by hour, keeping in mind that the reference to hours in this book, the hours are longer because the Chinese day is divided into 12 hours. So each Chinese hour is actually 2 Western hours. Since the poem is 7 pages long, I'll read you only the beginning and the ending, which I believe is enough to illustrate the point I want to make. And it is entitled Song of the 12 Hours of the Day. And that's, again, long hours. The cock crows, the first hour of the day. And the first hour of the day would be between 1 and 3, I believe, in the morning, our time. Aware of sadness, feeling down and out, yet getting up. There are neither underskirts nor undershirts, just something that looks a little like a robe. Underwear with the waist out, work pants in tatters. A head covered with 35 pounds of black grit, in such a way wishing to practice and help people. Who knows that? On the contrary, it is being a nitwit. Sun level with the ground, the second hour of the day, a broken down temple in a deserted village. There is nothing worth saying about it. In the morning gruel, there is not a grain of rice. Idly facing the open window and its dirty cracks, only the sparrows chattering, no one to be friends with. Sitting alone, now and then hearing fallen leaves hurry by. Who said that to leave home is to cut off likes and dislikes? If I think about it, before I know it, there are tears moistening my hanky. That's the first part, and I'll read the last part as well. This part is midnight, 12th hour of the day. This feeling, How can it cease even for a moment? Thinking of the people in the world who have left home, it seems like I've been a temple priest for a long time now. A dirt bed, a torn reed mat, an old elm block pillow without any padding. To the holy image, which is the statue of the Buddha, not offering any Arabian incense. And Arabian incense is the finest incense one could offer, so there was not even decent incense to offer to the Buddha. In ashes, hearing only the shitting of the ox. That made quite an impression on me. So the poverty and harshness of temple life is one possible explanation why Zhaozhou's line of descendants was short-lived. Another possible explanation is that Zhaozhou was a Chan master of the old style, with no desire to become a master of a larger, more prominent temple. Likewise, the few who did try to carry on his lineage may have also been small temple people, choosing instead to live as fishermen and farmers. However it may be, Zhaozhou's successors are only documented for two generations to about the year 1000. Thus, even though Zhaozhou's personal line of descendants was not in the mainstream of Song Dynasty Chan, the power of his Chan teachings was preserved and utilized by later generations. He's featured 5 times in the Gateless Gate, which is a compilation of koans, which I'll refer to later, and another 12 times in the Blue Cliff Record, which is another compilation of koans, 2 of the best known compilations of koans. Now, I'd like to review a classic koan, one in the question and answer format that involves Zhaozhou and Nanchuan. It is taken from the Gateless Gate, case 19, and numbered 1 in my reference book. It is the first one of the recorded sayings of Zhaozhou in this book, and number 19 in the other collection. I recall reading that somewhere that Zhaozhou was 20 at the time. The case is entitled Ordinary Mind is the Way. In any case, it would have taken place quite early in their relationship. So the case reads like this. With all his heart, Zhaozhou asked his teacher Nanchuan, "What is the way?" Nanchuan replied, "Ordinary mind is the way." Zhaozhou pushed. "Should I direct myself toward it or not?" Nanchuan responded, if you try to turn toward it, you betray your practice." Frustrated, Zhaozhou asked, "How can I understand the way if I don't turn toward it?" Nanchuan explained, "The way does not belong to the realms of knowing or not knowing. Knowing is delusion. Not knowing is blankness." I think there's another translation for blankness, which is sort of folly or almost stupidity. "When you have attained the way, you will find it as vast as outer space. How can this be approached in terms of right or wrong?" And with these words, Zhaozhou awakened. That's the story. That's the koan. So, as koans are dealt with, there are many commentaries, and there are several commentaries in English on the koan in this collection. And so far, it is the only koan anthology to have such richness. I want to refer to the commentary by Robert Aiken, probably the first Westerner to be fully authorized as a teacher of the Koan Way. And these are some of the comments. This is part of the commentary. In response to the direct question, Nanxuan replies, "Ordinary way is the mind." So, what is ordinary mind? Robert Aitken reminds us that this ordinary is not the commonplace mind of self-centered preoccupation. Self-conduct, speech, and thought obscure the vast, moonlit mind of Nanxuan. But as we hear in the Song of the Jeweled Mirror Samadhi, you are not it, but in truth it is you. This ordinary mind is not the commonplace of our self-centered preoccupation, but at the same time, yes, it is. Ordinary mind is the ordinary mind without the colored glasses. It is the mind when we are, just for a moment, letting go of having to be right and of knowing. It is the ordinary mind of curiosity, of not knowing. The ordinary mind from before we've settled, it is the ordinary mind from before we've settled into our various certainties. This leads us to two realities, seemingly contradictory, knowing and not knowing. When I know something, I'm stuck in that place. It may even be right, but it remains a trap. There is a larger liberty. The response of not knowing can be openness, but it can also be dullness. It can be a lack of engagement when we're called into engagement. Each direction comes up against walls. Each direction has traps waiting to ensnare the unwary. The invitation is to see those worlds of knowing and not knowing, of going and holding still. After all, they are where we live. Here, now, we must pick and choose. And also, we live in a world where there are moments of not choosing, of just being, where everything is so close, so connected, words like one make a lot of sense. Each is a gate into wisdom, and very much each is a trap. The way to which we are being invited is one of letting go of our certainties, of finding the silence at the center, and then acting. The linchpin for many of us is found in that silence. How do I find that silence? Do I move toward it? No. Do I move away from it? No. Bring your mind's eye, bring your heart, and bring your whole being into the moment and let go. These things, movement, refraining from movement, mind, heart, letting go, just let them flow. Let past and future go. Don't worry. They're never fully gone. In the moment, you are not those things, although, of course, they are very, very much you. Let the words settle into you, but don't hold them tightly. And a little more of Aiken's. And then be present. Here your ordinary mind will appear. No capital letters, nothing special, just this. And it is the gateway into freedom for yourself and for all beings. It turns out it's all about love. Presence, intimacy, love. As ordinary as ordinary can be. Here, not only does Zhaozhu awaken, and so do you, and so does the world. I go back to Aiken's comment on the ordinariness of presence, intimacy, and love. These, for me, were somewhat unexpected comments. As Zen is generally known to be intellectually rich, and little is overtly said of its emotional or intimate richness. Well, preparing this talk and becoming better acquainted with Master Zhao Zhu has changed my mind. First, I experienced a deep intimacy, humility, and inner strength in Zhao Zhu's poem that I read earlier. The feeling was heightened as I read the tender and loving eulogy prepared by the King of Zhao Zhu following Zhao Zhu's death. And I will read it to you. The Son of Buddha inclines toward the west. The seal of the patriarch breaks. A pearl sinks into crimson mud. The moon loses its shine. Shadows spread over the small room, and that'll be the room where the master lies, and the fireplace weeps. Breezes stir in the meditation hall, and the pines softly moan. The one sandal suddenly came, and its traces are left behind. In the five heavens, where can he be met again? Disciples who have understood emptiness transcend joy and sorrow. Yet, with the flowing tears, they face the snowy drapes. And the snowy drapes would be the drapes around the coffin. And I found that very loving and very rich in intimacy. And so with those tender words, I end this talk. And thank you all for your practice.